To hell with them Sicilians. It was just an offhand comment, a remark that was usually delivered with a smirk. Dino Banyan and his Northsiders were quick to say it. They didn't care. The Southside mob run by John Torrio and Al Capone, they were tolerated. They weren't pals. They were business associates. And if it wasn't for the money they made for O'Banion and his crew, they'd have nothing to do with him at all. So, to hell with them Sicilians became a remark that often passed between them with a laugh. Other people, though, didn't find it so funny. To a Sicilian, it was a deadly insult, a quip that would eventually mark a man for death. And that man, of course, was O'Banion himself. And as brash and confident as he was, he never saw it coming. For 3 years, O'Banion had remained in the good graces of Torrio and Capone. In fact, after the death of Frank Capone, he'd made a lot of dough from that uneasy friendship. Capone had not forgotten the extravagance with which O'Banion had prepared the arrangements for his brother's funeral, and he maintained a grudging fondness for the Northside gangster that likely kept the man alive even longer than most expected him to be. O'Banion's business flourished, not just flowers, but bootlegging, netting him almost $1 million a year. He supplemented his income with daring hijackings, which captured high-quality whiskey. On one occasion, his guys raided a warehouse that contained almost 2,000 barrels of liquor, which he replaced with water as a joke. Despite all this, he wasn't happy. Officially, he was allied with Torrio and Capone, which offered him protection from rival bootleggers and the numerous freelancers that lurked around Chicago. But even though he contributed men to the Cicero election, he felt slighted and unappreciated. To improve O'Banion's mood, Torrio had offered him a small piece of the action in Cicero, a beer territory that added up to less than 20 grand a month. Walking around money by the standards of the Torrio organization, but it was still something. Well, O'Banion took it and ran with it. He owed his talent for making money to the fact that he was a little bit crazy, and he proved this once again by encouraging speakeasies to actually move to Cicero. Torrio and Capone were impressed and more than a little resentful. Capone complained about giving him the territory to begin with and urged Torrio to take it back. But ever the peacemaker, Torrio proposed that O'Banion kick back a percentage of his new business in exchange for a percentage of his income from prostitution. The deal was typically Torrio, linking possible adversaries to a mutually beneficial enterprise. But O'Banion, like many Irish Catholic racketeers, hated prostitution, a filthy business they believed was better left to the Italians and the Jews. During his time as the leader of the North Side, not a single brothel could be found in Chicago's Gold Coast neighborhood. So he refused Torrio's deal. And that wasn't the only cause of friction between them. O'Banion tolerated Torrio and Capone, but outright despised their closest allies, the terrible Guinness. The Guinness sold their homemade poison for just $3 a barrel, half the price of O'Banion's high-class whiskey. Each of their stills produced as much as 350 gallons of the wretched high-proof stuff every week, with ingredients that cost less than $1 a gallon. When the Guinness began selling their whiskey in O'Banion's territory on the north side, he asked Torrio to send the Sicilians back to their own neighborhood on the west side. Torrio stalled for time. He knew how dangerous the Guinness were, heavily armed, entrenched in Sicilian blood oaths, and connected to the police, and he didn't want to get involved in the dispute. So O'Banion dared to do what no sane bootlegger would do and hijacked a truck that carried $30,000 worth of Guinness liquor. The Sicilians were infuriated, but with Torrio acting as a peacekeeper, the animosity between the O'Banions and the Guinness stopped short of bloodshed. Even though the situation was close to boiling over, O'Banion made matters worse by developing his own private relationship with the police. Capone complained about this, saying, quote, "He was spoiling it for everybody. or we'd been paying a copper a couple hundred dollars, he'd slip him $1,000. He spoiled him. In return for his money, O'Banion received information he planned to use against his bootlegging partners in a complicated scheme that proved how clever and how reckless he could be. It was a scheme that hammered the final nail in the coffin of Dean O'Banion. Welcome to American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of America. And welcome to our latest season, Murder City. American Hauntings is written and performed by Troy Taylor, that's me, and is produced and co-hosted by Cody Back. And this season, we're taking you to Chicago in the Roaring Twenties, an era of Al Capone, rival gangsters, jazz, flappers, bootleg booze, speakeasies, gambling joints, dirty politicians, corrupt cops, and of course, the ghosts, the violent days left behind. This is episode 9. Of season 10, Murder in a Flower Shop. In the spring of 1924, O'Banion paid a visit to the Hawthorne Inn in Cicero. He met with Torrio and Capone and stunned them with the news that he planned to retire from the bootlegging business. He explained he was tired of dealing with the Guinness and wanted to live and leave behind the dangerous life in Chicago and settle down in Colorado. Although they didn't want to show it, Torrio and Capone were thrilled by the news and were even happier when O'Banion offered a deal to buy him out. The three men jointly owned the Sebin Brewery, and O'Banion offered to sell his share for $500,000. He even volunteered to transport the last shipment of beer as partners. It was scheduled to go out on May 19, 1924. Torrio and Capone immediately agreed to his terms and saw that O'Banion received his payment in full. But unknown to Torrio and Capone, O'Banion's offer to sell his share of the Sebin Brewery was an elaborate ruse. Before the meeting, he'd learned through his police contacts that the brewery would be raided by the police on the night of May 19th. Typically, a brewery raid was of little concern in Chicago. It usually just meant that a precinct captain had not been paid off or wanted more money, and it was easy to avoid if the right amount of cash ended up in the right pocket. But this raid was different. This time, under orders from the U.S. attorney, federal authorities ran the operation with Mayor Deaver's full approval. Since Torrio already had a prior federal conviction for violating prohibition laws back in 1923, a second conviction would lead to a hefty fine and, worse, a mandatory jail sentence. On the night of May 19th, the raid on the brewery occurred just as O'Banion knew it would. Torrio and O'Banion were supervising the loading of the trucks that would take the beer to speakeasies all over Chicago when the police broke in and arrested everyone there. Torrio was arrested, and so was O'Banion, so he could maintain the story he knew nothing about the raid. Only Capone managed to avoid arrest. He wasn't at the brewery that night. Once Torrio was delivered to the federal authorities, he realized that O'Banion had betrayed and humiliated him. Seething, he was soon free on bail, but he was later convicted of owning a brewery and was sentenced to 9 months in jail and a $5,000 fine, all thanks to Dean O'Banion. After the raid and Torrio's arrest, O'Banion's days were numbered. Strangely, though, he seemed utterly oblivious to this fact. He worked each day at the flower shop, cheerfully greeting his customers and spent evenings at home or having dinner with his friends. Months passed, and he remained blissfully unaware that two of his partners were plotting his demise. Well, one of them was. Capone badly wanted to have O'Banion taken out, but Torrio hesitated. He was angry, but he knew that O'Banion's death would spark an all-out war in Chicago. It wasn't long, though, before even Torrio was pushed to violence. On November 3rd of 1924, O'Banion and Jaime Weiss came to the Ship, a Capone gambling establishment in Cicero. They came to divide up beer profits with the partners. Business proceeded as usual until Capone mentioned that Angelo Genna had racked up $30,000 in debts that had never been paid. In the interest of preserving peace, Capone suggested they just forget about it and forgive the debt. O'Banion, though, adamantly refused. He went straight to a telephone, called Genna, demanding that he pay the debt within a week or else. Capone and Torrio were taken aback by O'Banion's threats. They were doing all they could to keep the murderous Genna's happy, but they couldn't control the reckless O'Banion and honestly weren't sure they wanted to. They wanted their money. When they left the ship, Jaime cautioned his friend about antagonizing the Genna's and John Torrio, but O'Banion laughed and waved away Jaime's warning, and then he added, quote, "Ah, to hell with them Sicilians." The remark was just as funny then as it had been all along. In fact, by now, it caught on with other Chicago bootleggers who felt the same way, but had never been brave enough to say the words, "To hell with the Sicilians." To the Genna's and other Italian mobsters, such words were the worst kind of insult. And together with Torrio and Capone, the Genna's put the final touch on their plan to get rid of O'Banion once and for all. The murder would be carried out the old-fashioned way, which meant O'Banion would be killed face-to-face at his place of business in the middle of the day, and everyone in Chicago would know who was responsible and why it had been done. To carry out such a public assassination, though, the Torrio Capone organization required the blessing of Mike Merlot, the president of the powerful Unione Siciliani. But Merlot wouldn't go along with it. Murder was bad for business, he told them, and as long as he was in office, O'Banion stayed alive. Well, Torrio took the news calmly, but only because he knew Merlot had end-stage cancer and wouldn't be around to protect O'Banion for long. He'd wait patiently, knowing the time for action would come. Well, he didn't have long to wait. Merlot died 5 days later on November the 8th. Initially, Merlot's death was a windfall for O'Banion, who sold mourners over $100,000 in flowers, including a massive floral version of Merlot himself that stood 12 feet high. Capone himself purchased $8,000 worth of flowers. Mixed in with all the other orders was one that was so small he almost overlooked it. James Genna, one of his sworn enemies, visited the store and ordered a wreath for Merlot's funeral. He gave O'Banion $750 for the arrangement and told him that some boys would return to pick it up on Monday morning. He left the shop quietly, barely speaking, but he was there long enough to scope out the layout of the place. The selection of Mike Merlot's successor as president of the Unione Siciliani brought Frankie Yale back to Chicago. As the head of the powerful New York branch of the organization, Yale had considerable influence over who took the corresponding post in Chicago. He conferred with Torrio and Capone, and the three men appointed Angelo Genna as the new president of the Chicago branch of the Unione Siciliani. As the man who'd been recently humiliated over a debt by O'Banion and wanted to see him dead, Genna had no objection to his immediate elimination. This finally put into motion the most highly publicized and significant gangland slaying in Prohibition-era Chicago, a murder that would turn Chicago into a city at war. On Monday, November 10th, 1924, 2 days after the death of Mike Merlot, O'Banion left his apartment and went straight to Schofield's flower shop on North State Street. There was still much to do in preparation for the funeral, and he spent most of the morning working on large orders for the event. He worked alongside three of his employees, surrounded by plants and flowers of every description. Late in the morning, the telephone rang, and the caller asked if O'Banion had the Genna wreath ready to be picked up. O'Banion replied that it could be picked up at noon. At 5 minutes past the hour, a blue sedan parked in front of the flower shop. The driver remained at the wheel with the motor idling. When the three passengers got out of the sedan, they left the door standing open. Gregory Summers, an 11-year-old junior traffic officer who was guiding some children across the street near Holy Name Cathedral, saw three men exit the car and enter the flower shop. He later said, quote, "Two of them were dark and looked like foreigners. The other man had a light complexion." O'Banion was in the back of the shop, working on a flower arrangement, but his janitor, William Crutchfield, was sweeping up flower petals out front and looked up when the three men entered. He assumed they were gangsters, like many of the men that O'Banion did business with. He didn't recognize them, but later said he thought his boss did, which was likely why O'Banion never drew any of the three guns he habitually kept hidden on his body. Wearing a long white smock over his clothing and holding a pair of florist shears in his left hand, O'Banion walked out from behind the counter and extended his right hand in greeting. He said to the men, quote, "Hello, boys, you want Merlot's flowers?" The three men approached O'Banion with smiles on their faces. The man in the center, either Frankie Yale or Mike Genna, depending on which version of the events you believe, reached out his hand. The two men beside him were almost definitely John Scalise and Albert Anselmi. They were shorter and stockier with dark complexions and would kill anyone on orders of whoever their boss happened to be at the time. Crutchfield heard the man in the middle say, "Yeah, for Merlot's flowers." He stepped closer to O'Banion, grabbed his hand in greeting, and pulled him close. The two men at his sides moved around him and drew their own pistols. Then, at close range, the center man rammed his pistol into O'Banion's stomach and, holding his arm in a vice-like grip, opened fire. The other two men fired their weapons, and the bullets ripped into O'Banion. Two slugs struck him in the right breast, two hit him in the throat, and one passed through each side of his face. The shots were fired at such close range that powder burns were found at the opening of each wound. From that point on, this method of murder became known as the Chicago Handshake. O'Banion died there on his feet. Then he fell over sideways into a display of geraniums. His own pistols were unfired. He never had a chance to draw any of them. The three men fled from the store, jumped into the blue sedan, and sped away as Gregory Summers, junior traffic officer, watched in amazement. With O'Banion's death, Torrio and Capone had taken out the city's most unpredictable and dangerous bootlegger. They'd also embedded themselves more deeply with the Guinness and set the wheels in motion to take over O'Banion's wealthy Northside territory. O'Banion's funeral for the Southsiders was not an occasion for mourning, but a time of celebration. Torrio and Capone were glad to see him go and were happy to contribute to his send-off, but it wouldn't be easy. The Catholic Church, under the authority of Cardinal Mundelein, refused to permit a funeral mass for O'Banion at Holy Name, the cathedral across the street from his flower shop and the place where a young O'Banion had served as an altar boy. Mundelein also forbade him to be buried on consecrated ground. But Torrio and Capone refused to let this dampen the festivities. They intended to throw O'Banion the most lavish gangster funeral Chicago had ever seen. For the next 3 days, O'Banion's body lay in state, as the Chicago Tribune put it, at a funeral home located at 708 North Wells Street. It was owned by John Sabaro, a man with a curious double life. Not only did he own gangland's favorite mortuary, but he also worked as an assistant state's attorney. In fact, he worked with William McSwiggin, the young hanging prosecutor who'd been so intent on indicting Capone for the murder of Joe Howard only 6 months earlier. O'Banion was placed in a $10,000 casket made from silver and bronze, which is surrounded by a mountain of flowers. As musicians from the Chicago Symphony Orchestra played solemn music in the background, mourners filed past the coffin to pay their respects to the fallen gangster. "Why, oh why," O'Banion's widow Viola sobbed, clinging to the arm of her father-in-law. Louis Altieri and Jaime Weiss wept openly. The pallbearers included that pair, along with George Moran, Vincent Drucci, Frank Gusenberg, a gunman in O'Banion's employ, and Maxie Eisen, a labor racketeer and the president of the Kosher Meat Peddlers Association. The funeral procession extended for a mile and included three bands and a police escort dispatched by Capone from the village of Stickney. Chief Collins, from Chicago, had issued an order that prevented Chicago police from joining the parade, or otherwise an embarrassingly large contingent of city police officers would have definitely been involved. More than two dozen cars were required to transport flowers from the funeral home to the cemetery, including a large basket of roses that bore the ironic message, "From Al." For blocks in every direction, from the street, from the windows of office buildings and rooftops, thousands watched the procession as it formed. It reached gigantic proportions. More than 10,000 people walked behind the hearse, and when they reached Mount Carmel Cemetery, they were joined by another 10,000 mourners who assembled at the gravesite. Mounted police had to clear a path through the mob so the motorcade could advance. Every trolley car in the area near Mount Carmel was packed with curiosity seekers. A grave was dug for O'Banion in a section of unconsecrated ground. This area, reserved for lapsed or excommunicated Catholics, was as close to holy ground as possible. At the grave, Father Patrick Malloy, who had known and liked O'Banion since he was a boy, delivered a short eulogy. Cardinal Mundelein had forbidden a funeral service, but Malloy defied him just enough to offer words of comfort and prayers, at least. 5 months later, Viola O'Banion managed to have her husband's remains disinterred and reburied in consecrated ground. Although this was brought to the attention of Cardinal Mundelein, he declined to have the body removed. A stone obelisk bearing O'Banion's name stands in the cemetery today, a short distance from not only some of his rival gangsters, but a few feet from a mausoleum that contains the remains of a bishop and two archbishops. This irony led Police Captain John Stieg to remark, quote, "Strange, ain't it? A murderer, and he's buried side by side with good men of the church." Capone and Torrio attended the service at the ceremony, although they knew that O'Banion's friends saw past the floral arrangements and empty words and knew exactly who was responsible for his death. A reporter came up to Jaime Wise and asked him who he thought was responsible for O'Banion's murder. When he suggested Al Capone, Jaime sarcastically replied, quote, "Blame Capone? Yeah, well, Al's a real pal. He was Dean's best friend, too." The mood was so heated that the mourners had been ordered to check their weapons until the funeral was over. It was likely a good thing. Capone and Torrio spent a long, uncomfortable afternoon being glared at across O'Banion's grave by Weiss, Drucci, and Moran. Louis Altieri's rage was kept in check until the day after the funeral. He threw out a challenge in a newspaper interview that afternoon. He told the reporter, quote, "I got no idea who killed Deanie, but I would die smiling if only I had the chance to meet the guys who did, anytime, any place they mention, and I'd get at least two or three of them before they got me. If I knew who killed Deanie, I'd shoot it out with the gang of killers before the sun rose in the morning, and some of us, maybe all of us, would be lying on slabs in the undertaker's place." Altieri even proposed a shootout, like the Wild West cowboy he so badly wanted to be, at the corner of State and Madison Streets. Altieri's newspaper comments angered Mayor Deaver. In his own interview, he said, quote, "Are we still abiding by the code of the Dark Ages, or is this Chicago a unit of the American Commonwealth? One day we have this O'Banion slain as a result of a perfectly executed plot of assassination. It's followed by this amazing demonstration. In the meanwhile, his followers and their rivals openly boast of what they'll do in retaliation. They seek to fight it out in the street. There's no thought of the law or the people who support the law." Well, as for the law, it certainly didn't have any respect for Dean O'Banion. Relieved that another gangster was out of the way, the police didn't try very hard to catch his killers. The investigation was half-hearted at best and, of course, went nowhere. As a matter of routine, they questioned Torrio, Capone, and the Guinness. All of them claimed to love O'Banion and said they were deeply grieved by his death, and they pointed to the large and expensive floral arrangements they'd purchased as proof of how much they liked the guy. Frankie Yale was also questioned, but he claimed to be in town only to attend the funeral of Mike Merlot. He had nothing to do with the death of O'Banion, he said. After making a statement to the police, he returned by train to New York. After the inquest, the Cook County coroner noted in the margin of the court record, quote, "Slayers not apprehended. John Scalise, Albert Inselmi, and Frank Yale suspected but never brought to trial." Officially, the murder of Dean O'Banion was marked with one word: unsolved. But of course, O'Banion's friends knew exactly who'd killed Dean. They knew that Torrio, Capone, and the Guinness were behind it. And as Jaime Weiss assumed the leadership of the Northside Gang, he swore an oath of vengeance. They would do whatever it took to kill Torrio, Capone, and anyone else they believed took part in the murder. And within weeks, the streets of Chicago were running red with blood. Thanks for listening to this episode of American Hauntings, and we hope you'll stay tuned for the postmortem section of the episode. It's coming up right after these messages from our sponsors. You ready?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Ready for a little more American Hauntings this week? Well, we're back with the postmortem, the part of the show after the show where we sharpen our knives and dissect the episode. My name is Troy Taylor. I'm the guy who narrates and writes the show. And across from me is my friend, co-host, partner in crime, and consigliere, Cody the Nose Beck, who's feeling a little under the weather today. So, I'm going to go a little easy on him this time.
Troy, so. the nose is down, man.
Yeah. Yeah. The nose is full of something.
Right? I know. Yeah. We got a runny nose. I don't know. There's a joke somewhere.
Something. There is a joke somewhere.
But yeah, it's luckily we're recording this on the holiday. So I didn't have to go to work today.
Yes. Gave you a chance to rest a little bit.
Yeah. It's how I feel is terrible, but we were talking about it before. It's the lack of sleep, like where I've noticed the older I get, the earlier.
Dude, it's not so easy anymore. I agree with you. I've been traveling so much and I came back. I'm so tired.
Yeah.
I can't seem to catch up, man.
Well, the older I get, I realize the sooner I start to like hallucinate or see things out of the corners of my eyes, you know, when I get with lack of sleep.
Yeah.
Used to be,
it's ghosts.
Or it's ghosts.
Maybe it's ghosts.
It's ghosts. No. I'm like walking down the alley to the gas station to get some water, and like I'm swear I'm seeing rocks move around and stuff, and I'm like, okay, I'm just gonna look forward.
God, yeah, yeah, that's not good.
Yeah,
it's not good.
I know how this goes though. As soon as I can actually crash and get some good sleep, I'll wake up feeling like my brain's normal again.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, enough.
Well, we'll try to keep you from hallucinating during the episode.
Yeah, enough about
during our episode.
My upcoming nap. Yeah. What's upcoming for you?
Yeah, yeah. Well, this week, I on Thursday night have one of those after hours, the after dark at the museum. Mm-hmm. I may or may not be talking much during it, but I will be there for it. I've got to have some dental work done on Wednesday, which I'm not very happy about, but it's rearranged a lot of plans. But I'm still supposed to do a Devil Came to St. Louis event on Saturday night. But, you know, I could probably do that one in my sleep at this point. Uh-huh. I've done it a lot, but I still enjoy it. So at least it'll keep me awake. But then after that, then things start gearing up as we head into the conference. So June the 5th, we've got a speakeasy night at the museum. We did one of those before. It was a gangster one where we did Prohibition whiskey. We're going to do Prohibition moonshine this time.
Wow.
Going to be doing Charlie Burger night. So that should be fun. Pub crawl on the 6th, River Road tour on the 12th. Pub crawl again on the 19th. And then of course we come into Devil Came to St. Louis and we're doing that one on the 20th. That is a non-dinner event. But so if you think, oh, I'd like to go see the Devil Came to St. Louis event and I don't need the dinner, or maybe I want to save some money and do it for half price, I can come and do it for just half the usual price, $24. You can just come and do the Devil Came to St. Louis. The concession stand and speakeasy will be open, but it'll be, you know, it'll be just a fun night, I think. So anyway, you can check out all that stuff. I just updated the website as well at dinnerandspirits.com. So check that out. And oh, yeah. And last thing, if you hear this tomorrow, which would be today, I don't know how to do this time travel thing, but May 26th, when this episode comes out, if you hear it that day, later that evening, I will be doing a live stream event via Zoom. So you can still get in on that. It is American Murder Houses. So if you're interested, you can still get in on that. It's $15 for your entire household, and it doesn't, no limit on how many people listen. So you can jump in on that. So you can do that at AmericanHauntings.net. But anyway, the rest of the other stuff, all the events and tours and things are at dinnerandspirits.com. And last thing I'll mention will be the Haunted America Conference. We don't have many episodes between now and then that we're going to be putting out. So we're going to use this chance to remind you that it is coming. Time is ticking. You're almost out of time to get signed up for that. Just a few weeks left, and we really hope we'll see you there. Numbers are already, you know, much better than last year. So as a lot of you know, if you follow my Facebook page, we're having some difficulties at the moment with advertising, in that we're not allowed to advertise. We've been banned from it because I shared, for honest to God, like the 8th year in a row, shared a post about a woman who committed suicide on May the 1st by jumping off the Empire State Building. It was a photograph that was run in Time magazine at the time and called the most beautiful suicide, a woman named Evelyn McLean. And got in a lot of trouble for apparently posting this. I did not know it. I'd been posting it before and posted it again, and I had no, I wasn't allowed to argue this. They just banned me from advertising anything on Facebook for 30 days. So we're having a little trouble getting the word out about some of our events. So anything you guys could do to share those would be greatly appreciated. 'Cause yeah, it's been very quiet, you know, with some of this stuff. So yeah, anyway. Whatever. Anyway, moving on. I just thought it was worth mentioning.
All we can do right now is hope for the best and move on wait it out, essentially.
Exactly. Waiting it out.
I guess maybe
by time of punishment, I've been grounded. Like I'm a teenager or something.
Yeah, Daddy
Except
Zuckerberg.
This time it's not my, you know, nightlife or, you know, my extracurricular activities. It's our business, has been grounded. Yeah. So anyway.
Oh man. Well, speaking of people that we're hoping to continue to keep supporting us, I want to give a shout out to our latest subscribers on Patreon. So thank you very much for subscribing to the show, to Shauna, Charles, Maria, Cara, and Charity, or Kara, I'm not sure. But thank you very much for supporting the show. Troy's still rocking and rolling with Holy Terror.
Yeah,
and
last week was the first episode of our the new season, season 7 of our alternate podcast. As you mentioned, Holy Terror, which I've described as a, quote, bloody story of murder, mayhem, and the only Catholic priest ever sentenced to death. Anyway, it was the first episode was mostly about, you know, floating body parts eaten by fish, but it was really leading into something. So if you're looking for a kind of a blood curdling and really kind of frightening story, this one has a lot to go from, you know, murder and mayhem to ghosts. And so we're just getting started on that. Next episode will pop up next week. So it's every other week, alternative from the American Hauntings show. And as a Patreon supporter, you get that show along with all the past episodes of that podcast. You also can get special discounts, shirts, advanced sales, and get a lot more than that. So please check it out. That is at patreon.com/AmericanHauntings. And we would love to have you as part of that family as well as this one. So, yeah, thanks.
Awesome. I don't have any listener reviews this week. No good ones. There were a couple angry ones, but I don't have any good ones.
Oh, good.
Yeah. But we always appreciate if you guys leave us a nice review on Apple Podcast. And if you hear your review read, you can text Troy on the hotline and we get some free cool stuff in the mail.
Yeah. Yeah. And, yeah, we always enjoy the constructive criticism. Mm-hmm.
I was not
aware of the other ones, but I just don't have to read them anymore.
So I'll handle that.
Yeah. It is what it is. So
Troy, because as they say, to hell with them Sicilians.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, to hell with them Sicilians. Just meant to be. Yeah, it was a Northsiders catchphrase that got picked up by other people too, much to the dismay of the Sicilians.
I can't imagine what.
Yeah. The you know, most of us would look at that and go, okay, man, yeah, really get a grip. But I guess in the 20s, you know, in the days before, you know, keyboard warriors and people who leave us bad reviews who are too cowardly to put their name on it, that kind of thing, or use fake names or whatever.
Yeah.
Back then, when people made insults like this, it meant a lot more than it does now.
Sure.
That's the only thing I can figure out from this.
Yeah. So, I can imagine having to make things, say things like these, like to people's faces. And
oh yeah. Yeah. Can you imagine? The way it used to be.
Oh man. Well, this phrase is going to come up a few times, but it's going to not maybe start the downfall of one man.
It's going to lead to the death and downfall of one man. I'm not sure it was it definitely was not the sole cause.
Of course.
I think it was something that, you know, people were looking for an excuse for a while.
Well, he gave them hell of an excuse.
He did. I mean, and, you know, up until that, I mean, you know, they got along with him okay, which seems odd when you're looking back at it now from our time period, and you think of these guys actually ever getting along.
Yeah, right.
It seems wild, but at the time they were getting along. I mean, Torrio, you know, saw it as a way. I mean, O'Bannon was making him a decent amount of money. You know, he was getting his cut. You know, everything was working out okay. Mm-hmm. You know, Capone had kind of a fondness for him, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, at least because he did such a great job with his brother's funeral. And that, I think, was really important to him. And I think they got along fine until, you know, O'Bannon. But, you know, the guy was a little bit nuts.
And
he was. He was kind of crazy. They all were. The Northsiders were a nutty bunch.
Well, you mentioned.
And they were dangerous.
You mentioned how, you know, he could credit a lot of his talent to the fact that he was a little bit crazy.
And I think that's why he got as far as he did. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why he had so much support in his neighborhood and in his territory. People liked him and they thought he was funny. And they, you know, he was a likable guy as long as you didn't cross him.
Yeah.
I mean, if you crossed him, then there was another side to his eccentric, dangerous behavior, and you know, when he didn't like somebody, he didn't care if they knew it. I mean, he got along with Torrio and Capone, but he hated the Guinness. Just hated them. They were, you know, he saw them as these cheap, dirty, you know, just, I mean, very, I'm sure a very racist viewpoint.
Of course. Yeah.
And, This fucking Irish guy. But
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't like him. He didn't like him, but he also didn't like him because they messed with his territory, they messed with his booze, they messed with his livelihood, and he just had no use for him. I mean, about as much use as he had for prostitution, which was zero. Irish gangsters did not go in for brothels and stuff. They left that to, as I mentioned here, as O'Banion always said, he left that to the Italians and the Jews. He didn't want anything to do with it himself, so that was always going to be an issue.
It's interesting just because, like you said, looking back, it makes a little bit more sense. But thinking, I mean, it makes a lot of sense, right, for area gangs even nowadays to work together as needed, because they all want to make money,
Sure.
right? Like that's
Sure. Oh,
at the end of the
sure.
day, and you can make a lot more money if you're not shooting each other and fighting all the
Yeah.
time. And
But
but
Torrio was one of the few guys who could realize that,
yeah,
though.
he can make that
And
happen.
it was the respect that other people had for Torrio that kept them from, like Capone, from blowing up, because after, a lot of the things O'Banion did, especially with this prank that he pulled with the brewery, if you want to call it a prank, I'm not even, I think that goes beyond prank.
So
That's
he's
just vindictive, and it was just a way to take Torrio off the board, is what it was.
so did they
Which was the dumbest thing he could have done,
did they steal the alcohol and put barrels of
Oh,
water
well, there was
there?
that one.
Oh, you're talking about
Yeah,
something
there was
else.
that one. I'm talking about that. That was a prank. That was a prank. They stole that. They stole that liquor out of, they stole that beer out of somebody else's. That had nothing to do with
I
any
gotcha.
of the guys. I mean, that was something that was a prank that O'Banion pulled that would have had a good fortune for Torrio because he would have made money off the beer. I was talking about Sieben Brewery. When he claimed he was going to get out of the business and, and lined it up for Torrio to be there when the cops and the feds showed up. That just seemed like a really stupid thing to do. I mean,
It
it just
reminds
does.
me of there's a Christopher Walken skit on Saturday Night Live called like Pranksters or something. And it's a like video of people pulling pranks and stuff, but then it's Christopher Walken who's much older and showing a video of this prank he did. And he's like, what did I watch? He's like, I pranked him to death with a tire iron. It's like
Exactly.
it's not exactly a prank if you're
Dude,
sending me
that's
to
not a
jail.
prank. Right. That's not really a prank. Because knowing that he'd already had one federal conviction, the second one was mandatory that he spend some time in jail. And he does. He eventually will. But the whole thing is just so dumb. And I mean, I just I don't I'll never understand it. No matter how many times I have, written about this and researched this story and written a bit about O'Banion, I'll never understand what he was thinking. I just won't.
I guess just
I don't get it.
when is enough finally enough, and it's just not. So
Yeah. I
you
mean,
got.
I think he had some plan to do something. Maybe he thought that with Torrio off the board, Capone would, knowing that he was, volatile and, would just kind of screw everything up. That's all I can think of, is that maybe he thought that it was his chance to move in on the rest of their territory because he, put Torrio away. I don't know. I really don't.
Maybe there's a power
I don't know.
vacuum there or something, or
Yeah, something. But yeah, the whole thing was really dumb. And at this point, Capone wants to immediately take him out. Torrio's like, yeah, I'd love to, but if we do this, we're gonna have an all-out war because O'Banion's guys are crazy, and I mean he was right. That's exactly what happens. But even then, Mike Merlo is like, yeah, no, guys, you can't. I know you're mad, but you're gonna have to work with this because we can't have it. I mean, it's gonna be bad for business because then it's gonna be a war, and then the public's gonna turn against us. That was what the big fear was. And of course, then what is it like 5 days later? Mike
He
Merlo
dies.
croaks, and so we're like, okay, well, that's over with now. So,
Just had to outwait him, or wait him out. So how did aside from what it, I'm guessing it just seems kind of obvious, but do you know any more about how they found out that it was O'Banion that set them up like that? Because I mean, I know they went through the trouble of arresting him too to make it look good and all
Yeah,
that.
yeah. I just he had too many. Torrio had so many informants among the police and stuff,
Okay.
and I'm not even sure that O'Banion knew that they knew. You know what I mean?
Oh,
I don't
okay.
think he knew that they were aware it was him, because otherwise, why would you show up
Yeah, that
a
seems.
short time later down there to divvy up, you know, proceeds from, you know, your percentages from business, and then he's down there, you know, mad because you got a Genna who's, you know, not paying his debts. And, you know, I mean, he wouldn't have come down and thrown his weight around and stuff if he had known that they knew. I don't think.
Yeah.
That's my belief.
That's
So,
that's a lot of hubris to assume that you've outsmarted everybody.
exactly. Well, again, you
Yeah.
know, you look who you're talking about
A little
here,
crazy,
you know.
yeah.
So, yeah, you know.
Can you tell me about the Chicago handshake?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we don't know for sure who absolutely killed O'Banion, but most historians believe that it was the two gunmen who did a lot of work for, you know, did a lot of work for Capone and for a lot of others. That was, you know, Anselmi and Scalise. But and I think it was Frankie Yale. I don't think it was Mike Genna, because if it had been a Genna who'd walked in, I don't think that O'Banion would have come out with a smile on his face,
That's a
you
good
know.
point, yeah.
So yeah, they walk in, they grab a hold of him. The guy in the middle, who was probably Frankie Yale, grabs a hold of him, takes his handshake, and doesn't let go. And when he grabs his hand, he pulls him toward him and holds on to him tight. And then the other two also grab him. And then while, you know, Yale has a free hand, he sticks a gun right up into his belly and pulls the trigger while the other two shoot him from the other side. And that's what became known as a Chicago handshake, you
It'd be
know,
so
grabbing hold of
loud.
somebody. And, oh God, yeah. In this, you know, it's not a big, the front room of this flower shop, I'm seeing all the photos, it's not a big space, you know, it's not. And it would have been so loud, and you know, and it happens in front of this janitor who sees the whole thing, but I don't care.
I
Who's he
mean,
gonna talk to? He's
it's,
not gonna, even if he'd recognized him, he would have said, I don't remember who they were. I mean,
No,
he says, hey, it's three guys, you know, and then you've got the only person who testifies, which should tell you a lot. The only person testifies is the 11-year-old junior traffic officer who is willing to say, oh yeah, I saw three guys. One of them was light, and the other two, when they say, you know, they were dark and looked like foreigners, that's immigrant, you know, Italian immigrant, you know. So that's just a nice way of saying that. But
Oh,
yeah,
man.
it's funny that the only person who doesn't have Chicago amnesia is the 11-year-old kid outside.
Who probably also, if it's like a little crossing guard, probably was trying to like get a
Oh
sense
yeah.
of,
Yeah, Mr. Boy Scout. Yeah, he's helping some kids across the street, and probably an old lady too, you know, and he's the only one that sees it. But
Oh,
the
man.
only, you know, but I mean, you know, Crutchfield, William Crutchfield does say, you know, he does repeat what the guys say. You know, he's like, you know, oh yeah, they came for Merlot's flowers, you know, but that doesn't really mean anything. He couldn't identify any of them, and he never did. When he was shown photographs of everybody involved, he always said, oh, I don't know, I didn't look close enough. Sure you didn't, you know.
Yeah, I don't blame you. I wouldn't have either. Talking about the mourners and the funeral procession and things, saying that no police were allowed to join the funeral
Yeah, in
procession.
the procession, because yeah, you know they would have, if it had, if Big Bill Thompson was still in office, I'm sure there would have been cops in the funeral parade. But as it was, no cops were allowed to be. The only cops in there were some of Capone's, you know, lackeys from Stickney. And you know, Cardinal Mundelein says, oh, he can't be buried in consecrated ground, won't allow a funeral service. But then, you know, you got this priest who defies him because he's buddies with O'Banion, has known him since he was a kid. They were probably altar boys together at Holy Name, but they aren't allowed to do anything there. And even when they bury him in unconsecrated ground at the funeral
or at the cemetery, they later very mysteriously gets moved into
Yeah.
another part of the cemetery. And then at that point, Mundelein's just like, fuck it. I'm not even gonna mess with it. It's not worth it anymore,
That's amazing. That's a
But
plot
it's a
line.
great, it's a really cool cemetery to go and visit, though, because Mount Carmel is a really heavily Italian cemetery. And there's a lot of really cool graves, very ornate graves out there. But like everybody, it's a who's who of Chicago gangsters out there. Everybody's buried out there, man. I mean,
Wow.
within walking distance of all of these other gangsters. You'll find O'Banion, you'll find Jaime Weiss and Vincent Drucci, and I mean everybody's out there. Capone, they're all over the place.
That's
And
nuts.
it's a lot of, well, I shouldn't say fun, but it
Yeah,
is fun. Go
we
wander
like
around
going
that
through
place and look
graveyards.
for gangster graves.
Yeah, that
Yeah,
does sound
so it's
fun.
cool.
I like the Jaime quote too. Blame Capone? Why? Al's a real pal. He was Dean's best friend too.
That's a good one. So,
The mood is so heated that the mourners had to check their weapons until the funeral's over. Most likely
I
a
mean,
good
can
thing.
you, can you imagine standing there? I mean, not only have they spent money, because I mean, that was the custom. Even if you killed the guy, you still bought flowers for his
Yeah.
funeral. And I can't even imagine what that must have been like to stand feet away from guys that want to kill you,
Right, yes.
badly want to kill you,
Yeah.
and you're an easy target standing there in the cemetery, except nobody has a gun,
Right.
So.
And well, you hope nobody has a gun anymore. And
Yeah,
I bet
well, that's true.
and everybody's probably still debating, is a bad idea to do it at a funeral, boss, but you might, so you
No.
never know, it's one person's gonna slip up, and
Yeah, that is true.
that would be very,
But
very
I think,
crazy.
though, that I don't think anybody would have as much as they wanted to, because just like leaving the guns behind, well, and buying the flowers for your enemy's funeral, that's the custom, that's the
Right.
tradition, and nobody's going to break it,
Yep.
and I mean that's the that's the code, the gangster code, I guess,
Yeah,
so
it's funny when the how there's sometimes there's honor among thieves sort of thing,
yeah, and sometimes there's not. But yeah, and then the Louis Altieri in the newspaper with his, I'm gonna shoot out in the middle of the street,
Right.
because that's the guy I told you about that had the ranch in Colorado, wore the giant cowboy hats and stuff.
Oh
I mean, he really wanted to be an old West gunfighter. So here he is, a high noon, threat, challenging them to a shootout, which of course nobody took him up on it, but it did piss off the mayor, though. So,
Yes.
and the police, who didn't even bother to, not they didn't really try to find out who killed him. I mean, it was a very perfunctory investigation. They
Right.
questioned a few people and let the whole thing drop. So,
Right. And I know you like at the funeral and the ceremony and everything, that's all good, but you ended it with within weeks the streets of Chicago were running red with blood. So I'm excited to see how crazy this gets.
Things are just about to get hot. There's going to be, let's just say, a lot more bullets flying in episodes to come. So yeah, it's just about to, everything's just about to break bad. So
Nice. Well, hey, it is now time for our Ghostwriter section. So if you have a question or comment about the world of macabre, you can email me at AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com. But I don't have any emails, but however, we have a hotline.
I do have the haunt line, and I do have some tip messages on the haunt line. So if you guys are, if you have a question or comment you want to make, and you want to do it on your phone, if you don't want to write an email, which you can also text us on the haunt line at 217-791-7859. And we may read it on the air if we can. So I do have a
We did
few
that
here,
really
the addressing
smoothly. We did that really
what?
smoothly. Go moving between my ghostwriters and hot ones stuff. It's
What are you
hilarious.
talking about?
It was funny, the handoff of that,
Oh,
because it was bad. It
okay.
was so funny.
Sorry.
No, I love it. It was
Oh,
hilarious.
well, it worked.
And yeah.
All right. So I'm gonna start this with our only message about problems with our sound. Just because this one's from Diana, our listener of the year. And she said to add to the data, because I know that we're still working on this, I'm wondering if it is something with your audio file. She says, I listen via CastBox and your recordings, including the commercials you voice, and I've noticed that sometimes too, are always lower volume than other podcasts, whether I'm listening in the car or in my earbuds. Then the generic commercials cut in and startlingly high volume. I'm not a sound tech, though. Just thought I'd give you some feedback from another podcast listener. So, yeah, we're working on that. So,
Yep, I hope that the
anyway,
last episode was better.
I hope so too. So
And yeah.
we're hoping that that we've seen some improvement with this. And I'm not sure if it's an any of the other podcasts. I'm not hearing it on any of them, but that's just me. So I don't know. But anyway, this is go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh,
What
I
were you gonna
guess
say?
I did get some tech advice though from our buddy Jeff Porter, who listens to the podcast and works with the Rabbit Place that does Dax Shepard and all them.
Oh, yeah.
He sent me some like actual tech specs as far as like you want it to be between this decibel, blah blah blah.
Okay.
And usually I'm just doing it by eye and looking at is it peaking, is it
Sure.
not peaking, but
Sure.
I took more time last time to try and actually get it within a range. So
All right.
we're listening to your feedback. We're doing
Yeah, we're
everything we
working on it.
can. And
Yeah, we're
thanks
working on
for
it.
bearing with us. You guys know that we've had sound issues before and we always overcome. So, you know.
Yes, so far we have. And
Yes.
we'll continue to do so. So, all right. Well, this one comes to us from Tom in the 618 and says to answer Cody's question about a bar concert venue in St. Louis called Cicero's. I don't
Yeah.
remember this, but
Yes.
it was located in the U City Loop, by
Yes.
the Church of Scientology.
No.
He says, I listened to the podcast on Apple, being a resident of Bethalto and not thinking clearly for when the previous episode came out during the storm of death for no postmortem. The waterspout video you referenced in this week's episode was filmed by my friend Abby. Yeah, I'm a friend of Abby's too. I know
Oh.
where she lives because they used to have an office right there. So,
Nice.
but yeah, it was her. She did film the video because I saw that's where why I saw it pop up on Facebook too. So,
Nice. Well, I'm
all
glad to
right,
know
this
Cicero's was
one.
real. Thank you very much.
Yeah, it was real. It was real. So this one comes to us from Ellen in the 618. And she said, this is Ellen checking in to say that the Buddy Holly episode, this is American Nightmares. It was our music episode of the last time. She says, and this is in capital letters, fan fucking tastic. My dad was a fan of all of these artists. So he grew up listening to the Big Bopper, Buddy Holly, et cetera. I've always loved Ricky Nelson and Del Shannon. Some of the things I already knew, some were new to me. You presented the details wonderfully. Thanks so much. She said, I didn't know about Waylon Jennings. I didn't know that Del Shannon was supposed to join the Traveling Wilburys. So I love them also. So yeah, that was a fun episode to put together.
I think you were the one
So,
that taught me about the way they picked who is going to get on the plane.
oh yeah, tossing, yeah, flipping a coin. Yeah, yeah,
Yeah.
yeah. But yeah, Waylon Jennings, tossed a coin with one of the guys. He was playing bass for Buddy's band. He had split up from the Crickets, and so he just kind of picked up some guys, and Waylon Jennings was touring with him, and he had flipped a coin to see if he'd get on there. And then he had said to Buddy, when Buddy found out he wasn't going on the plane, he said, man, I hope your old bus breaks down on the way, just joking with him. And then Waylon said, well, I hope your plane crashes. Oops. Yeah. Yeah. He didn't mean it, obviously, but it bothered him for the rest of his life, as you might imagine.
I don't
So,
blame
all right.
him.
Well, this one comes to us from the 770, and it is also about American Nightmares. We will have several different things coming here, but
Sure.
different shows. But A. Troy wanted to reach out to say, I really enjoyed Devil Goes to the Movie series. I've always had an affinity for classic horror, particularly Boris Karloff and Vincent Price films. But you're going to love this next episode then. I recently watched Seven Footprints to Satan. These were things I recommended. Haxan and the Black Cat and Curse of the Demon, which is the episode that we did the last time. So keep up the great work. Thanks for hours of entertainment. So yeah, if you like Vincent Price, you're going to like some stuff in this next episode because he plays pretty big role until we get to the main feature of the next episode. So, and then this one says, this one comes from the 618, and all it says is, yes, a Bobby Fuller episode. That's all it says. I've had some other ones, and I use this as an example. There have been some other ones, some other people who have asked me about a Bobby Fuller episode. If you don't listen to American Nightmares and you missed the last music episode, the one that we were referring to that had Buddy Holly in it, Bobby Fuller was one of the people affected by what became known as the so-called Buddy Holly curse. And his story is so strange.
Yeah.
But I asked people if they wanted to hear a full episode about Bobby Fuller.
There you go.
If you do, I've had a couple of people say yes. If you do, please let me know, and I would be more than happy to put one of those together. So this one is from from Cindy in the, I'm not sure where she is, in the 847. So that would be Northern Illinois. Says, not sure if you were able to get messages to Adam of American Dread, but he's killing it with the new podcasts. Uh-huh. Great stories and fantastic presentation. It's been a great addition. So that is really nice. And,
well, thank you. We'll pass that on.
This one is, and I think this one is also about Adam's show. This one comes to the from the 309, and it says, I just listened to your podcast about Kimberly McCluskey, which that was Adam. Mm-hmm. I remember that case well. I was 20 years old, lived in a small river town less than an hour away. And it was very scary. I also remember for years following her mother would stand outside the Walmart store in Canton showing pictures of Kimberly, asking everyone if they could had seen her.
Oh, oof,
that's sad.
Yeah.
You could see the desperation in her face. It was so very sad.
Damn.
So, oof, yeah, that is... yeah, that is sad.
That's some American Dread right there.
Okay, this is another one that has nothing to do with podcasts. This is a question about the museum, so I'm going to leave that one out.
Right.
But anyway, so the guys, that is this week's messages from the Haunt Line. Had a little bit of this show, a little bit of all the shows.
Yeah,
in this one. So thanks. We appreciate it. But anyway, if you do have questions or comments, you can send them to the Haunt Line at 217-791-7859. All right.
Right. Let's do it.
Well, ready to wrap this thing up?
Yep.
So you can go back to bed.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you.
All right, man. Thanks again for checking out the story and postmortem for this week's episode of American Hauntings, which is part of the American Hauntings Podcast Network. We hope you'll give all of our shows a try, the current ones and the ones coming soon. And if you love them as much as we love making them, you'll tell other people about them and encourage them to listen. If you get a chance, leave us a review wherever you listen, which makes it easier for others to find us. Let's say thanks for your support. We've got a discount code that's just one word, podcast, and that gives you 10% off any books, tours, or events you purchase from our online store, which you'll find at AmericanHauntings.net. You'll also find a link there to Cody's shirt store where you can use the same discount. That store is at AmericanHauntingsClothing.com. Just remember, this podcast is not the only thing we offer. American Hauntings is also books, tours, ghost hunts, dinner events, the Haunted America Conference, and the American Oddities Museum in Alton, Illinois. And while that makes the company sound big, we're just a small business that's grateful for your support more than you can possibly know. And please share us right now. We are...
Yes, we really need it right now.
Cannot advertise, and we need your help. So
we need
anyway,
it more.
Turning it over to Cody.
The conference is at 1 month from today, dude. I mean,
know.
The 25th.
Yeah, I know. I know. It's wow. Coming fast.
It's coming fast. Well, hey, this episode of the American Hauntings Podcast was written and narrated by Troy Taylor and was produced and edited by me, Cody Beck. Oh, wait, by Cody Beck. That's me. Okay.
Oh, well. You tried. You know,
I think, did you switch it up on me?
No, right. I did not, but you're ill. So
that's true.
You know,
that's true.
A good excuse.
The words are moving around on me.
You're plain sick. You know, as they used to say about, you know, Walter Payton.
To find out more about the show, check out the show notes or go to our website, AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com. You could find out more about the podcast network there, or you can reach out to us with comments, questions, suggestions, or complaints via email or by text on the Haunt Line. You can also sometimes find us via social media, sometimes, where we post stories and updates on Facebook.
Unless we've been banned.
Yeah. thanks again for listening. We definitely wouldn't do it without you. So until next time, goodbye.
So long.
See you later.
We'll see you later.
Whew, all right, I made it through the whole thing without getting sick.
Coughing or,
Yeah.
yeah.
This episode was brought to you by the American Hauntings Podcast Network.